I'll try to do better.
No, it's good.
You're listening to Please Be Reasonable, where we seek to speak humbly and passionately about things that matter and things that don't.
Hello, hello. Welcome to Please Be Reasonable. I'm your co-host, Josh.
And I am your astonished co-host, Sam. Josh, you took that from me.
Well, since you didn't have the earbuds in, I wasn't sure if you were going to know when to come in, so I just went for it.
Josh, I'm grateful for how kind that was, and I'm astonished at the audacity you had to try and take that from me.
Me too. But
I would say it's good to be with you tonight, but I'm not sure if I'm sure anymore.
Well, Sam, why don't you tell our listeners why you don't have your earbuds in right now?
Yeah, so tonight's going to be really cool. We have a live in-studio interview with Mr. Dr. Andrew Ingracia, who is not a real doctor. And so we only have two mics and two monitors. So I'm actually using his mic right now, and he's got the monitors in. And just a minute, you guys will hear from him. But it'll be cool. It's gonna be a unique evening, a unique discussion for us.
Can we call you Agnostic Andy?
Sure, why not?
Kind of some alliteration there.
That makes it sound like he has like a Pathos blog or something, but yeah, sure.
Yeah. yeah, so let's see.
What's going on in your life right now, Josh?
What's going on in my life? Man.
I heard Kingley's got a new single.
Oh man, that was so great. Let's back that up. Let's just pretend that didn't happen. Hold on. Wait for it.
So what's going on in your life, Sam?
Nothing much interesting, but you know, Kingley has a new single out, which is pretty cool.
Oh yeah, what's it called?
Don't know. I knew you were gonna ask, and then I was like, I should have looked that up. Hold on, I'm getting to it right now.
We're off to a great start here tonight.
Oh man, this is bad.
This is how the sausage is made.
Oh, this is so bad.
Is this the kind of stuff that I always expect you to edit out, and then I listen to it later and it's still there?
So anyway, Kingley has a new single, which is pretty cool, called Consume Me. Have you listened to it yet, Josh?
I have not. Is it like the DC Talk song?
It is a cover of the DC Talk song. Oh no, I have a little quick sample of it here, but you guys should check it out. It's not free, like their first single, but it's pretty good. So you guys should check that out. Check them out on iTunes or whatever. They're obviously big supporters of the podcast. Kingley, shout out to you guys. You're awesome. Real quick trivia about that song specifically. Josh, do you remember, I don't think we've said this on the podcast before, but do you remember a long time ago when things were really terrible and we were in a band together?
Oh, how can I ever forget?
Yeah, we had that terrible band together. You remember that? And it was really terrible.
Yep.
Do you remember how I had a terrible guitar amp?
Yes.
Because everything about that band was terrible?
Almost everything.
Yeah, except for you. Logan used my amp in this song.
And he made it sound awesome?
Yeah, I know. I was like, what the heck, amp? Why didn't you sound like that when I used you? And it didn't respond. But anywho, you can see it even in the music video. There's this little moment, and I'm like, that's the closest I will ever get to any form of recognition for musical talent is a guitar amp that I own getting used by an actual musician making actual music. So a little bit of Kingley trivia for you.
Well, there you go.
Oh man. Well, this has been the worst introduction ever made by us. So we love you guys and we're going to jump straight to it. Andy is here. So I'm going to pass him the mic and we'll get to chatting. Sound good?
Yeah, let's give it a go.
Cool.
Hello, Andy.
Hey, what's up?
Thanks for coming out today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So Andy has been listening to the podcast. We went to school with Andy back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And we have talked about that school a couple different times.
Have you ever? Are you allowed to say the name of the school?
Yeah, do it.
I don't care. Okay, no, just wondering. I don't think I've ever actually heard you say the name of the school.
Are we trying to keep it secret to, like,
protect the innocent?
Yeah. I don't know.
Get sued for libel or something. I don't know.
I mean, I think that's on both our Facebook pages that we went to high school there, so I don't know if we're keeping it secret.
It's not a secret. Living Word Christian High School, O'Fallon, Missouri.
Woot woot!
Actually, it's just Christian High School. Right? Living Word Christian School is the grade school, and then CHS.
I think something changed. Like, I think it's not just CHS like anymore.
I'm out of the loop. I don't know.
I don't know. So we go way back to those days, but gone separate ways. But Andy found the podcast through our connections on the internet, I guess, and has been listening to it, and he wanted to hear us talk about apologetics and, some basic stuff about why are we Christians, or why do we believe in God and in Jesus Christ? Because he's kind of gone through his own journey on exploring some of those questions. And we just thought it'd be great to have some dialogue and talk about these things. For one thing, Sam and I both know a lot of people that grew up with us that have grew up in kind of the Christian subculture environment and have grown up and gone on and kind of deconstructed their beliefs or deconverted or decided that they didn't believe all the same things they grew up in. And
yeah, I've heard you guys use that word deconstruction. I never heard it used in this context before, but I think it's very appropriate. It's a good word.
You know, I've never actually heard it completely defined. I kind of picked it up from the Ask Science Mike podcast because he talks about it all the time. But I kind of, it feels like it's used in the context of meaning, like taking something that you already had but didn't really build it yourself. It's like a belief system and kind of taking it apart and examining all the pieces and then deciding what you're going to keep.
That's a very good description
of what you want to rebuild or how you put it back together or whatever.
Yeah, a lot of it's connected also to the fact that a lot of specifically Christian dogma is built around this idea of like specific individual doctrines. Like, this is true. It's like kind of like the brick wall analogy for how we build our theology. Like, we have this truth and this truth and this truth, and they build on each other to create a foundation. And deconstruction language is used around the idea of when you start removing specific bricks, it changes the entire structure. Can I say really quick, too? I think I've said this on the show before, but my earliest memory of Andy is when he helped me cheat on a Bible verse test. We were supposed to have a Bible verse memorized. And I had it written out in like one of those folders, but it was like, I mean, this was the early 2000s. It was like see-through plastic. And the way I had it sitting, you could see through it and see the Bible verse. And he like nudged me in the test and was like, "Hey, move your book."
It's a delicious irony there.
But anyway, I think we all think that these are discussions that we should have more of and more dialogue between Christians and non-Christians, agnostics, skeptics, whatever terms you want to use. It's important to talk about things and think about what we believe and why, and examining things especially in a spirit of open dialogue and friendship, and not some of the kind of antagonistic stuff you get on the internet in different places. So thanks for coming on, Andy. And
well, I appreciate you guys having me. I love the podcast. So good to be here.
Well, thank you. Do you want to share maybe just briefly kind of your background, how you grew up, what kind of journey you've been through, where you are now?
Sure. Well, I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian family, immediate family, extended family. My dad's a pastor. I was pretty well entrenched in the Christian, the same kind of niche Christian subculture that you guys described early on in your podcast. I was church every Wednesday and youth group on Sunday and church camp, and went to Christian school. I went to college to study Christian ministry. And very briefly, just that experience of going to school to study it, kind of studying it in an academic perspective, just kind of left me thoroughly confused and conflicted. And by the time I left, I wouldn't have described myself as I would have described myself as a Christian, but a thoroughly confused one. And over the process of maybe 5 or 6 years afterwards, eventually I just kind of realized that I wasn't a Christian anymore, for a lot of specific reasons. And I would describe myself now more or less as something of a skeptical agnostic. I like to describe it that way. I'm not a big fan of labels. I don't want to be lumped in with any kind of group, you know, but...
Standard millennial.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
That's a lump of its own.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, lots of different labels come with various connotations and baggage, whether it's fundamentalist or atheist or...
Yeah, I feel like if I say, oh, I'm an atheist, people associate that word with jerks like Dawkins and stuff. You know, I don't know. I just don't want to be lumped in.
I like skeptic. It sounds like a non-threatening and...
Yeah, and the reason why I say that is I'm not... I don't discount the, I guess, the... like intelligent design arguments. I think that they're somewhat compelling. I see why people are impressed by them. I don't want to just write that kind of stuff off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're not. So before you would have said you were pretty confident, certain in your Christianity.
I guess, yeah.
When you were.
But I don't think I really thought about it that mm-hmm. much until I had to, like mm-hmm. sitting at a desk. And
it's not that you now say you're completely certain.
No. I don't think that a reasonable person can say I am 100% certain of pretty much anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of a general uncertainty there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask a personal question?
Yes.
So you don't have to answer this if it's too personal, and I'll just cut it out. But how has your personal deconstruction of your faith, how's that affected your relationship with your family and your dad as a pastor?
Well, honestly, I would say that this has given us plenty of conversation fodder, and we love to. I really like to. We both like to talk about it and debate. We both have a lot of fun. I think we both find it pretty intellectually stimulating. Problem being, the only time we really have the opportunity to do it is at like family dinners and stuff, where it's not really appropriate. And as soon as the conversation kind of gets started. My older brother likes to kind of get on it too, but my mom will get up and walk away from the table, and my wife will start rolling her eyes. And you know, so there's not a whole lot of context where it's really appropriate to get into it. But I wouldn't say it's negatively affected my relationship with my family in any way.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, so you kind of have, so we've dialogued a little bit in some email, mm-hmm. And you kind of sent three questions or three main ideas or things to consider. And I just want to kind of step through them as we kind of talk about how you, kind of your worldview now or how it's changed. And then Sam and I can give some comments as well. So we're kind of getting into kind of the fundamentals here of why we believe what we believe, what do we know to be true, what do we think to be true, what could be true.
And the goal of asking these specific questions is more or less to get down to like the absolute basics, the conceivably foundational questions you could ask, you know, about why are you a Christian? Why is this your worldview? And you know, I see these as being more or less like the most foundational questions. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the first thing is, you know, why do you believe that any God exists at all? Not thinking about the Christian God specifically, Christian worldview, but just general theism. Why believe that a God exists as opposed to no God? Mm-hmm. So Andy, how would you have answered that question if someone had asked you that when you were a Christian?
I think I would have said, obviously, like the intelligent design type arguments, you know, the complexity of the universe, certainly seems to be quite orderly, kind of coupled with that, kind of like the first cause kind of arguments. So you got intelligent design, then first cause being, you know, there can't be an infinite regress of events. There had to have been a first cause. Something can't come from nothing, you know, that kind of argument. I don't know how maybe the moral law kind of argument that would kind of fit in there too.
Yeah. And so do you now find that kind of thing unsatisfying as far as, like there being problems with those ideas, or do you just think it's not like a level of proof?
Yeah, I would say the morality argument, which I think you guys ought to do a whole podcast on that because I think it's a really fun subject. That one I would write off for some very specific reasons. But the intelligent design stuff,
which morality argument's basically the basis of Lewis's argument.
Yes,
in Christianity. Mm-hmm. That's pretty famous foundational evangelical argument.
Yeah, and I really held on to that one tight, you know, back in the day. But as far as the intelligent design, complexity of the universe, stuff like that, I'm not the most scientifically literate person in the world, and I'm not going to quote, you know, that kind of stuff. I don't think that you can look at the complexity of the universe and the orderliness of it, and it doesn't lead to any specific conclusions. I get that it's a useful argument. I think that the fact that, you know, we're here having this conversation, you know, it's amazing that we're here at all. And the idea that that could have happened by accident is hard to imagine. I appreciate that argument. I think it's stronger than a lot of people would like to admit. But at the same time, I don't think that there's any specific conclusions you can draw. Like, so the complexity of the universe, there's a gap between recognizing that, but then claiming that you believe in some specific deity, or, you know, Yahweh, for example.
So you see it as reasonable for someone to believe in God or a God based on kind of the fine tuning arguments, different things like that. Whether or not you believe in a God because of those arguments, you at least see it as reasonable for someone else to believe in a God based on those things.
I guess so. I'm not there, but I understand, and I'm not one of these people who's going to look down my nose at you and think that you're an idiot because you think that. I think it's at least somewhat plausible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then this leads to your second question, which you kind of alluded to. If there is some kind of deity, you know, by what sequence of conclusions do you go from there must be a generic God to Yahweh's God?
That I think, in short, I think is basically an unanswerable question.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you would have had an answer to that before?
I don't know. I mean, I think it basically comes down to faith, and that's probably what I would probably say something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't I don't think I was that thoughtful of a Christian back in the day.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, what led you to pursue Christian ministry?
A very idealistic. I just figured, I believe that this is true, the Christian worldview, and God didn't have to make me, but He did, and I'm only here for a blink of an eye. You know, right now isn't as important. You know, eternity. You know, right now, I wanted to spend my time doing God's will. You mm-hmm. know, I was put on the earth for a reason, and I wanted to figure out what that reason is, and I want to become the most informed, prepared Christian that I can be, and I want to go out in the world, and I want to fulfill my mission, my divine mandate, or whatever. You know, I don't want to spend my time selling widgets and accumulating material wealth. I want to go out and do something significant, and there's nothing more significant than spreading the gospel and, you know, doing mm-hmm. whatever it is that God put me on earth to do. So yeah, I guess that's more mm-hmm. or less.
Yeah. I want to talk a little more about, some arguments or reasons for going from a generic God to the Christian God. But kind of continuing on that conversation, could you talk a little bit about the, you mentioned that this book by John Hick mm. was kind of a catalyst for you. Could you kind of explain that a little bit?
Well, all it is really, is like the culture we came in. I feel like kind of the traditional apologetics, the traditional Christian apologetics, you know, you got the ontological argument and the cosmological argument and the you got this whole list of arguments that we were all fed, you know, growing mm-hmm. up. And this book more or less states the argument as it was originally stated, a little bit of commentary from the author, some traditional rebuttals. It's not like he's arguing one way or the other necessarily. He's just kind of putting them all out there in a nice, clean outline for you. So mm-hmm. it's not like I was being convinced by the author. I just, looking mm-hmm. at it that way, and I just remember like becoming more and more and more unimpressed by mm-hmm. these arguments that I used to, that were so important to me.
Mm-hmm. When you'd only heard them kind of presented in a very definite, positive way without, but not rebuttals to them. And so just kind of seeing side by side pros and cons.
Yeah. I mean, I was neck deep in the culture, you know. I didn't have leaders that were anything other than fundamentalist evangelical Christians, you know, so.
We talked about this a little bit on our episode on evolution, but I think in kind of that conservative evangelical upbringing, a lot of times, anytime these sort of arguments were brought up, any rebuttals to them were always mentioned, like, in passing, because they're so ridiculous. They were presented as so ridiculous and so weak that they even give them the time of day would be a waste of your time. And so, I mean, this was the experience of a lot of people, I think, that came out of our context specifically, but just that general context, is all of a sudden you realize, oh, wait a minute, like, these rebuttals are, like, really well thought out and really excellent and actually carry weight. I mean, that was huge for me.
That was certainly my experience, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention, you could... I think I might have made a substitute teacher cry once just by asking a question that, you know, related to something like this, and just not received well, you know, mm-hmm. in that context.
Yeah, so you felt like some of these things hadn't been as fully explored, and now that you were fully exploring them, it was at least more ambiguous or less, you know, totally certain.
Yeah, than I you guess previously so. Thought. I would say that. Yeah, pretty much, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then that kind of leads us to our third question, or the third question you had. How much is simply faith? How much is informed reason? What is the value of each?
Yeah, I think, and a lot of that, you know, that question kind of hinges on your definition of faith, and it might be helpful to maybe try and agree on a definition. I like... Hick's definition, which is, I don't recall what it is verbatim, but it's more or less believing a thing with insufficient information and by a conscious effort of the will. In other words, I just believe it because I want to, even mm-hmm. though there isn't a whole lot of data to support that belief.
That's a good definition. It's important to mark that sort of definition because that's not the way basically any evangelical would use the word faith. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can even think about, like, growing up, the analogy is always used when we talk about what is faith. It's always mm-hmm. like, well, I don't understand the mathematics of, you know, how chairs work, but I have faith that it won't collapse when I sit in it. Like, that's kind of, I mean,
I think both uses are. I think there is a set of evangelical use and thinking where people do say that kind of thing. Like, the Bible says it, that says that I believe it, you know, almost in the face of evidence or thinking through it. It kind of that blind faith, which some even see as like a virtue to have just a blind faith in God.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't know how you guys feel about that. I just think that, and I guess that's kind of the approach that I came up with. And I would say mm-hmm. that's not a good thing. You're giving up your ability to reason independently and think critically, and you're just giving up that right.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with that. And I actually was just listening to an audiobook of Cold Case Christianity by J. Warner Wallace.
Yeah. Do you know that? I just listened to that.
He was a detective and he used to investigate murders and stuff. And my dad bought me that book. I haven't read it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you've read Case for Christ,
right? A long time ago, yeah.
It's kind of like the new Case for Christ. But it actually has some new stuff that I thought was really interesting. So this whole conversation has kind of gotten me back into apologetics a little bit after I kind of took a break for a few years because I felt like it was just people yelling at each other and nobody convincing anybody of anything. And like, I'm just going to go try to show the love of Christ to people in real life and just worry about that. But I've kind of been getting back into some of these things a little bit. And in Cold Case Christianity, he talks about he contrasts what he calls a blind faith, and says that some Christians do hold that, but he sees that as not a proper faith, and that he believes in a reasonable faith that he calls like inference from reasonable facts or information or beliefs.
Yeah, that's like what I was
inference about the things you don't know based on the things you do know or the things you believe you have reason to know.
Yeah, I did read that part. I remember that.
I would say too, and this is painting with a really broad brush, but I think when you take those two understandings of faith, right, this idea of inferring from evidence that maybe doesn't get you all the way there, but making an inference, and then the whole just that God said it, that settles it, blind faith aspect, I feel like there's a pretty common correlation there where the farther you get down the road to conservative fundamentalism, the more weight is going to be placed on that blind faith, childlike faith aspect. And the closer you get to more middle-of-the-road conservative evangelicism, the more you're going to see that kind of inference, kind of popular apologetics view of faith.
So there might be a little bit of a spectrum there, but I would say that regardless of where you are on the spectrum, there is always going to be at least some element of, I mean, faith is a big piece of the pie for a reason. You know, it's a necessary component, and it's talked about a lot in the Bible. It's very, you know, it's something that's admired, you know, supposed, it's admired, and it's a quality worth having and admiring in other people's faith. And I would argue that it's not admirable. It's not a good thing. So that's where I'm at. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know, Sam, maybe you can speak a little bit about, I feel like there's a, I feel like there can be a virtue in that kind of faith. But I'm not ready to articulate like a defense of that.
The blind faith
thing? Yeah. Like there's an element to it that can be virtuous, like trusting in God in spite of not having all the answers, like that sort of thing. Like if you are confident that he's real for other reasons, kind of a thing. I'm not ready to like completely articulate that because I also totally understand like the rational view of like, why would you believe something without having the evidence? And why would you have a blind faith? Because this gets into something that Andy has written about regarding if you're going to have a blind faith in Christianity, why is that better than having a blind faith in something else?
Yeah, I have two pieces here. I mean, I can give kind of the pat theological answer that my church would give. You won't find it in the slightest bit satisfying because I don't even find it satisfying. But I mean, because I come from a more reform theological base. And so we would say that, you know, faith is a gift supernaturally given by the Holy Spirit. So you have it because God chose to give it to you, which, you know, I think that can have some beauty to it theologically and can do some really cool things for the church.
Until you throw in the evangelical Christian kind of concept of hell.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. and then it gets kind of hairy.
Yeah.
But I guess my issue with this, and this is probably more just making it a bigger question than answering it, is I feel like there is potential for a blind faith, a childlike trusting in God to have really beautiful benefits for humanity and for the world around you. I can think of examples where people made choices to trust in God and trust his intention and trust his sovereignty in spite of not knowing things, and it turned out really beautifully and really beneficial for the world around them. I can also think of examples of how blind faith has turned out into destructive extremism that is terrible for the world around you, whether that's, you know, Westboro Baptist Church or ISIS. Like there's an aspect of that that can be just as easily culturally destructive.
The question, I guess, that I'm getting at is what is the, like, say you're a non-believer and you transition to becoming a Christian that involves adopting faith. So what can you describe, like, what's the initial motivating factor behind, like, taking on that kind of faith at the start? Like, what should motivate a person to have that kind of faith?
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that like, if you kind of go back to square one and you deconstruct your faith and you try to reconstruct it rationally, I don't think you can. I don't think you got to, like, turn that part of that rational part of your mind off in order to fit faith in there. Because I think by definition, it's kind of an irrational thing to be willing to accept a thing without some real tangible data to kind of support that way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. I don't really have that perspective on faith as being necessarily irrational. I don't know if I can completely articulate that right now.
I think I do. We don't have to talk about that right this second, but I think I agree with them.
Okay. I feel like I would make a case, and this is kind of still in process for me, and so I'm actually kind of interested to kind of be developing this, like, in conversation with Andy to get pushback and good criticism on. But I, in trying to think through some of these questions for myself, I'm kind of developing a case where I would, given the common ground that we at least see it reasonable to conclude that there is some kind of deity or could be a deity based mm-hmm. on the universe and so forth, like we said, which we would say there's not, those things aren't direct evidence of a deity. It's circumstantial evidence that you can make a case, that it all makes sense to be explained by a deity. Mm-hmm. It's circumstantial evidence that can point in favor of a deity. Whether or not, you know, how strong you think that is or other alternatives or whatever. And so I think there can be developed a case for, there's also circumstantial evidence that points to the resurrection of Jesus as being a historical event. And if that is the case, then I think that on its own kind of would prove Christianity as truth.
It's kind of an important hinge point.
And so, like, I feel like a lot of Christians kind of come at that by saying, like, the Bible is 100% true, inerrant, infallible. Therefore, the Bible says Jesus rose from the dead. Therefore, it's a fact.
Done.
But God
said it.
I think it's interesting but kind of what that does is then you're defending the entire Bible, and then people bring up all these questions about different parts of the Bible and, oh, this isn't true or this is a contradiction or whatever. And then you spend all this time defending all those things, where even though they're not necessarily connected to the resurrection. So it's interesting to think about a framework of just taking, not settling the question of inspiration or inerrancy for the moment, but just looking at, we have these documents that refer to the life of a man named Jesus, and, you know, can you build a reasonable case that the documents were written early in the first century, or early to the time when this person lived, and then can you make a reasonable case that at least the people that wrote these documents themselves believed the events to be true and had reason to believe that. And then, you know, from there, say it's at least you can make a reasonable case that the resurrection as an actual event explains the circumstantial evidence more satisfyingly than an explanation of it being a conspiracy or something like that.
My concern with that is you might be able to construct a fairly interesting case about the man Jesus and, you know, some details concerning his death but can you make a strong enough case with those tools to create a worldview? You know, that's a very serious, really quite dramatic thing, you know, to adopt a worldview. And especially like a worldview, like a religious worldview, specifically the Christian worldview, where once you adopt it, it just changes the whole way that you think and you perceive the world and the way that you behave and the way that you spend your resources and your time. It's such an important, significant thing, life-changing thing. And is that data, that circumstantial evidence, is that enough for you to feel comfortable and satisfied adopting mm-hmm. this worldview? And for me personally, I don't feel comfortable enough with what's available to take that on, because it's really a big, heavy thing. And if I'm gonna adopt that worldview, I need something tangible, something real.
Can I ask Josh just real quick, based on your own argument that you constructed, if you had that and that alone, would that be sufficient for you to land in that place?
Well, see, that leads into kind of the next part of that, of this idea I'm developing, is there's also an aspect where I feel like your Christian faith has to become personal and real and experienced, or it doesn't have to be, but it's much stronger and sturdier if it is. And so for me, like, I feel like I have a confident experience with God, with Jesus, through just as I've, you know, as I've followed him in my life and sought to seek his direction in my life, and just different things that have happened in my life that I feel like have confirmed those things, you know, just from the even just stories of why we're here, why we bought this house, how we got here, you know, and answered prayers. And for me, even all of that is part of a heritage of events and experiences in my parents' lives and my grandparents' lives. It all is kind of
reaffirmed
and kind of all comes together. And so it's all this, reaffirming and confirmation for me. And even though I understand that other people don't necessarily have that, for me, it's kind of a combination of like the rational arguments that present a reasonable case that it could be true, combined with the experience that makes it real and confirming. So it's kind of that two-part connection to me where how I explain that leap or the gap of the intangible and the tangible, I guess.
Yeah, personal experience is very important. You read my response to that would be more or less that, what, like, if we had a Muslim sitting right here that was describing his personal experiences, and then you describe your personal experiences, but you hold competing worldviews, you know, what do you say to each other about each other's experiences?
And I've actually literally had a Muslim student living in our house,
really?
And he told me a story of a coincidence that happened to him that he saw as evidence of the divine. And it's kind of this like shared rapport between us. Like, we both believed in God and have these experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, what do you do with that when you, you know, you look at some of like the competing truth claims in the Bible versus the Quran and stuff. And if you're both having profound spiritual experiences, what do you do with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, some of this, you know, different people have different opinions that they can state strongly. I actually listened to an audiobook by Nabil Qureshi, who was raised Muslim but became a Christian. And it was interesting because he also talked in his story of growing up how he had some experiences that confirmed his belief in Allah. Different coincidences and dreams and different things. But then he also, he had this Christian friend, and they did lots of apologetic like debates with each other and stuff about their respective religions. But in his personal story was, once he started to investigate objectively, or as objectively as he could, the claims of his religion and the claims of Christianity with, you know, the textual basis for the documents and the history, what's the historical evidence of, you know, Jesus and Muhammad and different things. He said he found that the case for Christianity was much stronger and the case for Islam was much weaker than he had expected growing up. Now, of course, he would say that because that's where he is now, and that's what he wrote the book to talk about.
I wonder what kind of consensus you can find in the Muslim world.
Yeah, I really don't know, like, because I'm not familiar with those arguments.
Interesting, yeah.
So you know, what the potential answer to that question would be that, you know, the rational arguments for the potential for Christianity are much stronger on an objective level. But of course,
you get some
those
disagreement
people would say
from
that. So I haven't thoroughly researched what rebuttals would be.
Yeah, and I'm sure you could find members of other religions too that would describe some, you know, they that have profound spiritual experiences every day, you know?
Yeah. And I actually, I would be interested to, like, if there is, like, if somebody's done, like, investigations on that kind of thing, like comparing, because with
really quick, you want to make sure they did investigative.
Well, I use it as an adjective, and then mid sentence,
regular investigation.
Mid sentence, I was like, it should have been a noun, but there's no way to turn it into one. You know, because like with, you know, my own personal experiences, stories like George Mueller autobiography, like so many things, like I feel like are so more specific than like other things that I've heard from other religions, but I also, you know, I don't have an objective sample size that I'm looking at.
Yeah, so. I think it's a great idea to do like a documentary really where you interview members of different religions and have them describe those profound spiritual experiences mm-hmm.
and then stories of miracles and different things.
But then the question is, you're a Christian, so what do you do with that information? Like what? Mm-hmm. How do you interpret the fact that these people from competing ideologies are having these experiences that would seem to affirm what they believe, but if what they believe is true, that would contradict what you believe, maybe, and that would kind of confuse things a little bit. I feel like
I think where I'm at now, like I said, with the familiarity that I have, I feel like the Christian experiences overall are stronger. Mm-hmm. Admitting like the bias in the sample size for me. And also going back to, like, I feel like the case for a reasonable belief in the resurrection of Jesus is strong enough on its own that, like, that would kind of trump everything else. Like, if without, unless I was presented with like a reasonable explanation for a competing reasonable explanation that the disciples all managed to hold a conspiracy that Jesus never came back or that the documents were written much later, different things that currently to me seem more unreasonable, given the possibility of a supernatural resurrection, which, you know, is interesting too. I think it's interesting that, a lot of, I'm really fascinated by the secular worldview that considers the possibility that the universe could be a simulation.
Yeah, I've been hearing a lot about that lately.
And, like, because from my point of view, it's like,
what a terrible simulation.
No, it's
if
like,
it's a simulation, why don't we have cooler stuff?
Well, I view that, and I see that as compatible with God, Jesus, being the simulator. Like, you know, even among all the religions in the world, like, the God of the Bible pretty much claims to be the simulator, having created the universe, and then Jesus pretty much claims to be the simulator made flesh. Like, I think it's interesting. I almost feel like people aren't considering, like, even as a possibility at all, that, like, somebody who claimed to be the simulator coming into the world and then like convincing millions of people, like that's at least a possibility as the identity of the simulator.
Well, the claim that the universe as we see it now could be a simulation that assumes a simulator, right? I mean, you can't have a simulator without a simulation without a simulator.
Yeah. I'm curious, just because this is on my mind, 'cause I'm getting back into some of these things. If you've done a lot of research on the competing claims about, like, what time period the documents of the Gospels were written, whether Jesus was historical or not, like, do you have opinions about those?
I do, and this is one of the things that threw me off when I was in school.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you learn about how long it took post resurrection. Death and how long it took after the life and death of Jesus to start writing stuff down, and kind of the literary standards of the day, and considering the literary standards and how low they were, and the amount of time that scholars quote unquote assign to that time period. That it makes you lose confidence real quick in the legitimacy of those books, you know. And I often say, like, during my time in the Christian ministry program, my theology went from being like hyper conservative to more and more and more and more liberal as I got close to the end, because the more you learn about what scholars have been saying for hundreds and hundreds of years, that they just don't tell you in a church service, I assume because it won't be very well received, it sort of forces you to adopt a more liberal theology. Like, an informed theology is a liberal theology, in my opinion, or just no theology at all, I guess, in my case. But yeah, I mean, do you agree with that statement at all? That an informed theology is a liberal theology? You went through the same program as I did, Sam. So
no, I don't.
Oh, snap.
Well, I do think it's interesting. I always thought it was interesting. Like, I knew that even before I had, you know, like, heard as much of things as I have now, like, I had this kind of idea that I knew that, like, more conservative scholars, like, dated the Gospels earlier and more liberal scholars dated them later. And it's like, well, of course that's what they're going to do. And I did wonder at one point, like, especially once I became more aware of, like, liberal theologians than I used to be, I always wondered, how did Lee Strobel manage to find all the conservative theologians for his book? Like, how did he not manage to get one of our, like, professors at school that would have given him different answers?
I'm sure bias had nothing to do with
it. I don't want to say anything negative about Mr. Strobel, but my guess is there was some design in that. But anyway.
Intelligent design?
Yeah, bazinga.
But that's what I was so interested about this J. Warner Wallace book, was he had some stuff that I'd never heard before. There's this guy that...
Before we go to that, can I speak really quick?
Yeah.
Just really quick to the education thing? Just because... And we don't have to make this a deal, but I do think it's interesting that we received basically the same theological education in our undergraduate program, but had, like, wildly different results in terms of how it affected our personal understanding of theology and spirituality and scripture. Mm. So, like, the statement you made, like, an informed theology is a liberal theology, I get that. I actually get that, and I'm incredibly sympathetic to that, but I disagree with it. And here's what I mean by that. I think an informed theology will not be a crazy fundamentalist conservative theology, which is what
we grew up with.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of what we grew up with. But my engagement in our theological training actually brought me to a lot. I mean, the same sources. I mean, I literally read John Hicks' book. I loved it. I still have it. I'm glad you brought it tonight. It was really cool. But it also pointed me to a lot of scholars in a more conservative camp who I think are incredibly more informed than a lot of the sources we were handed growing up in our subculture. And so I don't think informed equals liberal. I think uninformed, but I do think, like, hyper fundamental conservative almost always equals uninformed, if that makes sense.
The dating, as far as adopting a more liberal theology as I went along, one of the big things was the dating, because that really can throw you for a loop, And then one of the other things, have you ever read the book Jesus Interrupted by Bart Ehrman?
Yes.
No, but I'm actually interested.
It's a great book. It is and it isn't. He's intentionally inflammatory, and he's not that interesting in a lot of ways, but a few nuggets in that book, like, really threw me. I took a J-term class. Actually, Garrett was in there, and there's four of us in the class. But anyways, we read that book, and the exercise of doing reading the Gospels, the way he describes it is like horizontal versus lateral reading. You remember this, Sam? Mm-hmm. Where you take a story from the Gospels, that's account that's recounted in more than just one gospel, and then you just set them side by side and compare the details, mm-hmm. and the differences in the details just like blew my mind. Mm-hmm. And what that, like, I think I went into that class more or less a sola scriptura person,
mm-hmm.
and And that just really threw me off. It mm-hmm. really did, and it really one of the things that really had an impact on me.
We don't have to make a big deal out of this. I don't want to just be like, I'm countering everything you say. Like, I don't want to do that. But I would argue that, well, I would agree with you. Like, that is insane. But I would argue the reason that experience was so profound for us is because we had an upbringing that taught us that the four Gospels were historical books that were, like, totally in line with each other. Mm-hmm. But history is the wrong genre for three of the four Gospels. Like, Luke presents himself as a history, but the other three present themselves as theological works.
Yeah, so
Sam. That's not liberal, that's just scholarship.
Compared to, like, CHS theology.
Yes. Yeah.
So I went from that.
I've only been invited to preach chapel there once.
Really? How'd that go?
Apparently not well, because it was only once.
Really? But yeah, so that when I say that I got more liberal as I went along, I was starting in a very, very...
Yeah, absolutely.
So, well, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's it's interesting talking about, differences between the Gospels, because if you come from a view of 100% inerrancy compatibility, then anything that threatens that, like, shatters the whole thing.
Absolutely.
But then if you come from a historical document perspective and you see claims that early Christians were treating all these documents and sharing them as mm-hmm. true and valuable, then either they were stupid and weren't aware of the differences themselves, or they were, like, okay with them. Either there were actual explanations that make sense when you hear them, the case for them, or they just didn't read them in the same way that we do.
Yeah, and I didn't like these things didn't cause, like, I adopted a more liberal theology. I didn't abandon Christianity immediately. But, you know, I kind of adopted that kind of perspective, you know, and I recognized that maybe our modern day, particularly our Americanized event, that culture kind of maybe bastardized their view of scriptures, maybe a little bit simplistic, especially compared to the way that the people closer to the time period where it was actually written, the way that they viewed and treated scripture. There's a big difference there. The modern day church did something really weird there, but yeah, I didn't. It didn't, like, cause me to abandon my faith, you know, out of the gate. I just, but it definitely was shook me up pretty much, you know, in terms of, like, well, I don't think I can hold on to this sola scriptura thing anymore, and this information at the same time, you know. So when I say something like an informed theology is a liberal theology, this is kind of what I'm getting at. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick, do we have to use an explicit tag now since Andy said bastardized and so did I?
You said it too? Oh, just now.
Well, it's not in that context. I don't think it qualifies as a curse word.
I mean, Josh said penis last time we didn't put an explicit tag on it, and now I said it too.
Oh man, it depends. Are we? If we were more conservative, we would make it explicit.
This is kind of jumping back in our discussion, but I think it all relates. So part of my problem with this whole discussion is I deeply agree with you on your very premise. Like the whole idea that a Christian faith, a Christian worldview can be reached, like, through logic, that gets taught and thrown around a ton in modern conservative evangelical apologetic circles. It doesn't make any sense to me. And I would take Josh's whole thing about how you have to have you have to have reason and you have to have spiritual experience, and they go hand in hand. And I would even say it's more extreme than that. I think you have to start, like, the first place has to be a supernatural, mystical experience. Because I think nothing, I think the corroborating evidence that goes into the reasonable aspect of Christianity and apologetics and all the things you described, I think those things only are weighty enough for you to actually make the plunge, as Andy said, to like really change your worldview in this radical way. I don't think the evidence is weighty enough to make you do that by itself. I think it only has that weight if it's coupled with an actual mystical, supernatural experience.
That sounds an awful lot like predestination.
Which, again, this is the Reform pastor talking. So, but yeah, it is. But I don't think you can get around that. Like, I think, and I know, like, I mean, obviously you listen to our discussion on hell and those things, but mm-hmm. I know that that makes this conversation stinky.
Yes.
In that regard. But I personally, like, and again, this is purely just my experience. If I did not have a supernatural, mystical experience of the person of Jesus, then the arguments we're making would be interesting to me mm-hmm. and as an intellectual basis and would do nothing to affect my worldview. But because I already had the mystical supernatural experience of the person of Jesus, those arguments carry a weight that actually brings me to make changes in my life and make sacrifices.
Well, that's that makes a lot of sense. Sounds awfully rational to me. when the idea, I'd be interested to hear your response to what I said about competing ideologies also claiming to have supernatural experiences. In your mind, like if there's a Muslim or a Buddhist or a member of some other competing ideology that an ideology that does compete directly yeah. with some of the truth claims of your ideology, in your mind, what's going through your mind as they're describing their experience?
Yeah, I have no good answer to that. Literally, I don't think there is one, and I may be totally wrong on that, but I can't think of an answer that's satisfying for me in that. And here's the reason: my own worldview is constructed so subjectively, based on the validity that I place on my personal experience. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like I'm saying, I had a mystical, supernatural experience of the person of Jesus. And that brings with it enough weight that I have taken on this worldview. And so if someone just tells me, no, dude, no, I had a mystic supernatural experience of fill in the blank, I can't really do anything about that. Mm. Personally, I don't have any, like if when I've had that experience specifically with Mormons, that's happened a couple times, I could dig through, you know, yours is this vague general burning of the bosom and look at this and like, well, and I could do those things, but I don't find that to be beneficial. Like my response to that, and this might sound terrible, is just to get like, it saddens me and I pray for the person. So like, I know that's not a good answer. Like that's not a satisfying answer, but I don't have one beyond that.
Yeah. I think when I would have called myself a Christian, I wouldn't have said it out loud what I was thinking as they're describing that situation, that circumstance to me, but I would be thinking something along the lines of, you're wrong. You're just wrong about what your experience, you were participating in some, it's just some absurd groupthink thing, or maybe you were being influenced by demons.
Yeah, exactly. I met Jesus, but you met a demon.
Yes. Something along those lines. I genuinely would have thought that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have said it because I guess I'm too nice. But
well, and you know, saying that out loud, those are probably the thoughts that would run through my head as I was trying to create a defense of my own subjective experience. Mm-hmm. But in terms of responding, I wouldn't have a response to the person beyond just validating their experience and then mm-hmm. personally praying for them to have a different experience.
Yeah. So maybe I've just never had a profound spiritual experience enough. I mean, I can't claim to have had a significant enough spiritual experience like that, you know, and I appreciate your honesty there. That's refreshing. So,
but I mean, like, okay, I keep taking the mic from Josh. I think that's the piece. Even when you look scripturally, the people who are leaders in the church are people who built their worldview after an insane mystical supernatural experience. Yeah. I mean, Paul, the great theologian, changed everything about his worldview because of a mystical supernatural experience that he totally believed to be true. And all of the theologians, like in his circle at that time, were like, no, you are wrong. This is terrible. And he was like, nope. And, you know, did everything we described. He made massive changes to his life and massive sacrifices to his comfort. Although, because of the weightiness he placed on that experience.
He had that experience, but then he went out and basically did apologetic preaching.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then when you throw hell in there, this also gets kind of squirrely, because I've never had a profound enough spiritual experience to motivate me to adopt the Christian worldview, or readopt it, I guess, I don't know. But so then you and I both die, you get to walk through the pearly gates, and then I'm boned. Because I was never given an experience significant enough to convince me. So God, in that case, more or less would have made a conscious decision not to save me. He would have given me this mind who requires, like, I have a compulsive need to have tangible data, you know, to make a decision of that caliber or whatever. But then he withholds his presence from me and then punishes me for it. So when you throw hell in there, this really gets uncomfortable. Regardless of whether or not, even in an annihilationist perspective, it's still squirrely.
Go ahead, Josh.
I was going to say, the Calvinist, you know, basically says, yep, that's the way it is. Sorry for you. And maybe that's being a little more snarky with it than Sam would be. I feel like the Arminius says, well, if you pursue God, if you ask him to reveal himself to you, he will, because that's the kind of God he is.
I mean, the Calvinists would say
that. Thomas doubted that Jesus, Thomas wanted to see, he didn't believe Jesus was resurrected until he saw the hole in his hands, and Jesus rewarded that and gave him the evidence, gave him the experience. So God doesn't look down on you for wanting that, and if you ask him for it, then he will give it to you. I hear that kind of thing. I can't speak to, you know, what the outcome of that tends to be, but
honestly, I think it's foolish to try and soften it. I think you're absolutely right. I think as a Reformed theologian, I don't think there's any way to have the discussion about predestination without it just being painful and terrible. Mm-hmm. And the only fallback, I think, a Reformed theologian, especially one, if you have a Reformed theologian who really strongly holds to a traditional Orthodox view of hell, the only theological fallback is, well, he gets to make those rules, not us. Yeah. But that's where you get guys like...
That's a tremendous cop-out is what it is.
Yeah, and that's where you get guys like Christopher Hitchens saying, well, if I met God, I'd be like, screw you, I don't want to come to your heaven. So, personally, and you can push back on this, I invite you to, I think an annihilationist view actually solves this problem. Because I think essentially what you have in an annihilationist view is God giving human life as a free gift to be experienced and to be enjoyed, and then making a conscious choice to give a greater gift to a smaller number of people, which I don't necessarily get that piece of it, but I look at the life given as like theologically speaking, as a benefit versus not having it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that it's certainly the annihilationist view definitely takes the edge off, for sure. It's less dramatic. It's less violent. You know, the idea of just sort of burning up and being gone as opposed to conscious eternal torment, there's a big difference there. But still, you know, the 13-year-old Middle Eastern girl who's raped and impregnated by an ISIS fighter in Syria. And then that baby grows up in that context, never is exposed to Christianity, never accept Jesus, goes to hell because of no fault of its own, and even if that person is then just burned up and gone, where's the justice in that? It's a lot less sadistic than being tortured forever in a lake of fire, but you're born, and then you're not exposed to the truth, and then you're held accountable for not knowing the truth, and you're punished for it. I see that as being an injustice, a less dramatic injustice than conscious eternal torment, but still an injustice. Still,
absolutely. I don't think this will be a fully satisfying answer, but one comment I would make on that, just to better represent the Reformed worldview in this, is the idea that evangelism, as it were, in a Reformed theological worldview, is not dependent on the believer and not dependent on the person's access to Christianity. So if you go back to the theological idea that faith is a gift supernaturally given by God through supernatural experiences of the person of Jesus, then God is working to advance his gospel and draw people to life and salvation even outside of a Western American Christian context.
Through Christians.
No, just through the supernatural working of the Spirit. So I think a holistic Reformed theology would say that there's a good chance that people in the Middle East, in the rainforest, and people who have no gospel access have supernatural gospel access, that God is meeting them in a way that they can contextually grab a hold of and understand, and actually drawing those whom he's called into his kingdom, regardless of whether or not they have, quote unquote, heard the name Jesus.
Yeah, I remember from good old Dr. House's classes, conversations about the general and specific revelations. So they have access to general revelation. They might not have access to specific revelation.
Right? Well, I would say a lot of Reformed theologians would say, no, they have access to special revelation.
Special, not specific.
Right? Yeah. Okay. But through a supernatural experience. Mm-hmm. So to give examples of this, like I hear reports from IMB missionaries in the Middle East who are in what they call like black flag countries, which are countries where it's illegal to be a missionary.
Yeah.
And they'll give reports again. So like I've been at like a missionary lunch where the guy's home for like a couple months and he'll tell these stories. So this is like, a third hand telling at this point, but I heard it from the guy who's claiming to have experienced this, so he's in a country where it is not known vocally that he's a believer. He's operating in secret, and yet he will have people from multiple cities over who will show up at his house unannounced, knock on the door, and say something to the effect of, I had a vision of someone last night who said their name was Jesus. I needed to come talk to you about something called salvation. I don't know what that is, with no context. So again, that's a fantastical story. But that is the sort of, I would say, spirit-led evangelism that I think a lot of people in my camp would say is a reality, that God is working in such a way to say, man, if this is a person whom I have called and elected, then it doesn't matter what access he has to the gospel. I'm going to make sure he has access to the gospel.
I would certainly hope that he would do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and
And I know that's not fully satisfying. I just wanted to make sure that aspect of the worldview is represented.
Yeah, and that, situations like that, I always recall that Thomas Paine quote that I sent to you about, I don't feel obliged to believe that, because of, coming second, third, fourth hand. And it's an experience that basically defies every experience I've ever had of reality. So unless I experience it firsthand, I don't feel obliged to really take that all that seriously. And even if it did happen to me, I don't know how I would interpret it. I'd have to, not to just discount what you just said, just saying I don't.
No, you are actually totally invited to totally discount what I said, because I understand the fantastical nature of that. I didn't I probably shouldn't have even shared the specific story because I wasn't trying to like be like, oh, let me prove a point about how God works supernaturally. It was more just to say like, this is that piece of Reformed theology of how they explain lack of gospel access in parts of the world, if that makes sense.
Do you find that satisfying personally?
Oh, how do I want to answer that? I find that satisfying enough. But again, I want to point back to my worldview is constructed around a mystical, supernatural experience of the person of Jesus.
You're more apt to take it seriously.
Absolutely.
I just want to say I will try to take some time to read that Sam Harris. Which book was really influential?
The moral mm-hmm. landscape. And
because I'd love to do
you've read it.
I'd love to do an episode on morality.
And I would recommend just to get the meat to watch his TED Talk because he distills mm-hmm. it down in like 20 minutes and it's just on the high points mm-hmm. of the actual argument.
So watch that first.
Yeah, if you want to read the book, that's fine. I feel like he goes off on a lot of barely related tangents. Uh-huh. And I wonder if maybe he just needed to fill. I know that publishers will only publish if you fill a book up, you know, and it's not even a big book to begin with. But if you want just the meat, which is enough really to have this conversation, I would recommend watching the TED Talk.
I'll do that. I would be interested if you decide to finish that Wallace book, just because I'm listening to it right now.
I got frustrated with it and I stopped.
So maybe you shouldn't.
This is going to sound terrible. I don't necessarily think you should finish the Wallace book.
Fair enough.
And apparently there's two. There's like
there's a follow up to it.
Sounds good.
So really quick, Andy, as we end out our time, I'm going to need you to go ahead and bow your head and close your eyes. And if you feel led to, I'm just going to say a prayer. And if you just want to repeat it after me, just really quick. We have a baptismal in the other room.
I'm good.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
Very good.
Awesome. Andy, thank you so much for giving your evening to hang out with us. This was incredibly beneficial just for me. I really appreciate your honesty and your honest questioning, but also just the kindness that you bring to it. The fact that you're actually respectful and gentle in the way you question and engage is really refreshing and I think missing in most of these conversations on both sides.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you guys had me on. Like I said, I love listening to the podcast and I'm glad to contribute and it's a good conversation.
At some point, we're going to have to pick apart Andy's manifesto and talk through it.
Oh, my favorite. Yeah, have fun with that. Yeah.
We always want to give a shout-out to Kingly. Thanks for letting us use your awesome music on a crappy podcast. Go check them out on iTunes or wherever you kids get your music nowadays. Spotify, Amazon Music, other places. I don't know. YouTube, Red.
Apple Watch.
Your Apple Watch music. Go on, check them out. They do have a new single. Go check it out. It's cool. I guess that's that, man. I guess I'm gonna go read a Sam Harris book because I'm a heretic.
I guess I'm gonna go read a John Hicks book because I'm a good liberal conservative Christian.